Some people take the straight path in life. But at Arizona State University, we respect your twists and turns. They make our online students more driven to excel in their professional lives. That's why our personalized suite of services empowers you with innovative resources and staff that sticks with you. Make your next turn with one of our 300-plus programs at ASU, ranked in the top 5 for best online bachelor's programs. To learn more, visit asuonline.asu.edu.
Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland.
On News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof, the podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. I'm Jonathan McRae. Thanks for downloading, subscribing and rating. We really appreciate it. Coming up on this week's programme, we'll be speaking to the brilliant and provocative John Krakauer from Johns Hopkins, who has brought a rather radical approach to rehabilitation after stroke by making it enjoyable. First, though, it's time to look back at the week's science news, and we're joined by Dr. Ruth Freeman from Science Foundation Ireland and science TV hunk Phil Smith. You're both very welcome. Ruth, our first story is about folding.
Yep, and it has to do with protein folding specifically. And we're very, very interested in protein folding because understanding how proteins work is the basis of how we discover new drugs. And this is work that was reported in Nature, and it's the third iteration of something called AlphaFold. And AlphaFold is part of Google's DeepMind research activity. And it first came out a number of years ago, and it actually won a competition to try and predict protein structures. So what you do is you feed a sequence of amino acids, which are the building blocks of protein, into AlphaFold, and it, using a database of many, many thousands of proteins that it's been trained on, will give you back a predicted structure for that protein. So the first one kind of did an okay job, but the second iteration, AlphaFold 2, that's been out for a number of years now, you know, really was significantly better. And, you know, while it hasn't been that great for drug discovery, it certainly has been excellent at helping researchers to try and understand the structure of proteins. But this is the newest iteration. It just came out this week. It was reported in Nature. And it's kind of made another huge leap forward, because as well as trying to predict the structure of proteins, what it's trying to do is understand how those proteins might interact with the other components in the cell. So if anyone's ever opened a kind of biochemistry or biology textbook, you'll see all sorts of diagrams of proteins, and they might look like ribbons curled up into helices. They might look like waves of lines going backwards and forwards on the page. And we know that these proteins do things like bind to DNA. For example, they're used to replicate DNA. So in these books, you'll often see the proteins shown as blobs, and they're sort of wrapping around the DNA. But in reality, we don't know how they move. It's very hard for us to understand that interaction between proteins and the other parts of the cell. But for the first time now, this AlphaFold 3 is going to give researchers that kind of information. So we'll be able to see how things like phosphorylation, which is where a phosphate group is bound onto a protein and helps to activate it, how's that actually working in the context of the cell? So it's like, you know, if any parents, if you've got that huge box of Lego at home that's filled with pieces of Lego, and you only have the instructions for 2 Lego sets, but using that, you can basically use this AI to predict everything you can make with those possible Lego pieces, and how, if you make different structures, they might even fit together. So it's a huge leap forward compared to AlphaFold 2.
Yeah, I think, as I said, I think last week, a couple of weeks ago, it feels like we're starting to get to the promise of AI, certainly in some parts of healthcare, and it's really, really exciting. Our second story, Phil, has to do with something called Dyson spheres.
Yes, and my nerd brain jumped out when this was mentioned and I saw it in the news, mainly because it was something I saw on Star Trek many moons ago on The Next Generation, where they saw this giant thing and they didn't know what it is. So a Dyson sphere was originally postulated by Freeman Dyson. So it's a thought experiment about what a civilization could do. So a Dyson sphere is a hypothetical megastructure that surrounds and encompasses a star and then captures a large amount of its solar energy. Now, we're looking at a ginormous structure. So think of the diameter of the orbit of the Earth around the sun, and that's where you're thinking of, like, around that you've got a giant ball encompassing a star. So you're looking at kind of the surface area. I did a quick calculation of about 250 million times the surface of the Earth. So there's these are ginormous structures. So they're something that we can't really just kind of build ourselves just yet, but it's kind of something that potentially, if you wrapped around the sun, you could harness all of its energy, having unlimited power to do whatever you want. So it's something that's really, really out there. And two research groups, one led by Matthias Suazo in Uppsala University in Sweden, and the other by Gabby Contrero in the International School of Advanced Studies in Italy, combined data from the European Space Agency's Gaia satellite, which is mapping the position of a motion of billions of stars in our galaxies with infrared survey data from ground and space telescopes. And they combined millions of stars in our galaxy, and they've kind of seen something that's surprising. They've seen mysterious spikes in infrared heat across dozens of these star systems. And they're saying that these spikes could be evidence for alien civilization harnessing energy with their own Dyson spheres. Now, this is way out there. Now, you kind of can just go, where is this evidence coming from? Where they're saying, like, there's a particular techno structure of this infrared glow that is giving this explanation. Now, there are simpler ones, but there is a possibility that these things are existing out there.
Yeah, this guy Dyson, basically he was suggesting that if a civilization had advanced to a high enough level of technology, that it would make sense to harness the sun around which its planet might be orbiting to get the maximum use of a particular star. That it would make logical sense if you developed enough technology that would be a great way of finding infinite power to do whatever it is that you wanted to do. And again, we're talking about, you know, something not infinite power, but a relatively infinite power. It does sound very science fictiony, but it is something that you might look across the entire universe and look out for. And that's what these physicists were doing. I think, you know, it is always still a huge stretch. I mean, just spotting some infrared energy from these items, particularly when we don't understand lots of things that are out in space and where those signals are coming from, to say that these are advanced civilizations that have harnessed the power of a sun seems a little bit of a stretch to me, Phil. You?
Yes, but there's no harm in dreaming sometimes. And like this is the kind of thing, if you go big enough, you know, can see what would happen. And civilizations could have been around for billions of years, potentially before us. Like there is natural phenomenon. Like it could be from something like two planets colliding and they produced an enormous amount of debris that has then like surrounded the sun and given off the signal like a Dyson sphere would have been, or they're hidden behind a galaxy. But I suppose a Dyson sphere should give off this type of signal. And if we're seeing it from 53 types of planets that they're seeing, there's no harm in kind of saying, well, maybe it is. Maybe there is more intelligent life out there. And if they have to be that level of intelligence to build that, maybe they need to be to get over to see us.
Yeah. But also, I think we need to think about, maybe we're not going to build a Dyson sphere, but what are the real prospects of getting solar energy from space? You know, and there has been much more realistic research which shows that could be possible for us and could be part of our transition to clean energy. So it's kind of inspiring to think big.
No, absolutely. And to get people to think about these ideas, these problems, I think it's kind of cool as well. If like, you know, this story breaks across the world, if 100 people start Googling Dyson spheres and get inspired, then that's pretty cool as well. Our third story has to do with inner voices, Ruth. Do you have an inner voice?
I think I do. And I was going to ask you guys the same. You know, do you talk to yourself in your head? Yeah.
Yeah, so it's usually very critical, super critical.
Well, there you go. Well, you are in the majority of people who have an inner monologue or an inner voice. And actually, until quite recently, we sort of assumed that everybody did that. But it seems that research is, you know, talking to people now, not everybody does. And this is work at apparently the first study looking at the difference in people with an inner voice and those who don't have an inner voice. And it comes from researchers in the University of Copenhagen and the University of Wisconsin. And they managed to find a group of about 100 people, about half of whom reported having no inner voice. And the researchers thought, well, if you don't have any inner voice, what impact might that have on how your brain works? And might it impact on things like your verbal working memory, which is sort of your ability to just remember things and store them short term in your brain? You know, your ability to think about things like rhymes and poems, you know, And also if you're good at switching tasks, because you might have sort of inner cueing going on in your head, telling yourself, right, I'm doing this now, now I'm going to do that. So, and how you sort of differentiate between confusing things. Does that voice help you as kind of a coach in your head? So what they did was, the first thing, they did a memory test on people and they got them to remember words that sounded similar, like bought, caught, taught, wart, and they got them to remember them in sequence. And what they found was, people who reported not having an inner voice found that much more difficult, probably because they weren't repeating them in their own heads. They did the next thing with pictures. They got them to look at pictures, and in the pictures, sometimes there was things that rhymed, like sock and clock. And again, people were less able to find those rhyming words in the pictures if they didn't have an inner voice. Now, when it came to task switching, there was no difference between them. But certainly this is a kind of an interesting, I would say it's very preliminary. It's a small enough group and a relatively simple experiment. But I think, again, it's just interesting to consider how different people's brains work. And when you think about the basis of learning and how we operate in the world, that there are some people, I mean, the three of us might not really be able to understand how those people are using their brain. They're sort of having to transfer between picture to action, as opposed to picture, word, action. And that might be harder for them.
I have my inner voice does two things mostly. Mostly it's telling me, don't F this up, don't F this up, don't F this up. And then afterwards it's, I can't believe you F that up. I can't believe you F that. And that's essentially my entire inner voice monologue. I think I'd be very liberated to not have it anymore. Our final story, Phil, is a really interesting one. It's about bad rumors.
Yeah, I found this quite, and it spoke to me in a particular way about how we can influence children, and particularly in terms of education, but also in our personal interactions. And the research that's coming out of Osaka University and NTT Communication Science Laboratories in Kyoto has found that children were more generous with multiple informants sharing positive gossip, but hearing one bad rumor was enough to hit the rewards of the children that they were talking about. And when I say rewards, they were doing research with 187-year-olds in Japan. They were watching videos of short videos involving a pair of puppet characters, one wearing a check shirt, one in polka dots, to make them easy to distinguish. And then they were to give out rewards based on how they felt about the characters. And it seems that one bad rumor can affect how children view each other based on what they were doing there. So it's really saying that, like, I suppose if you ever have that thing where one negative comment really hits you hard, but it needs about 10 more to kind of undo it, it's kind of speaking to that kind of language and how we hear different things and respond to them in different ways. The researchers kind of think, though, that this may be something that's, I suppose, functionally adaptive for children to adjust their behavior based on negative gossip to avoid harmful situations caused by future interactions with malevolent persons. So basically what it's saying is that if you have a bad interaction or someone, you hear something bad about someone, you're protecting yourself by then avoiding that person so that you will be safe. So it's kind of like a safety mechanism or kind of a growing up mechanism. However, it's kind of a little bit scary that if somebody says something bad, one thing person says something bad about you, a 7-year-old is then going to be like, oh, okay, that's it, you're gone. And based on other research, 7 years old to 8 years old is when kids start really manifesting their ideas about what career they're going to go into, in terms of area and in terms of type of person that they want to be. So if this is the age where those things are being formulated, bad opinions could have a really massive impact on their future.
The good news is I only ever spread good rumors about the people on this program. So that's great. Dr. Ruth Freeman from Science Foundation Ireland and Phil Smith, thanks very much. Yes, you're welcome back to the programme. If you'd like to get in touch with the show, you can email us science@newstalk.com or you can WhatsApp us 087 1400 106. Now, strokes, as you know, are bad. They can have a devastating effect on patients. They happen a lot more than you think. And what's more, we often do not treat people with strokes in a way that we could. Professor of Neurology and Neuroscience at Johns Hopkins, John Krakauer, is in Dublin to give a talk about his work in sort of revolutionizing how we treat stroke patients. And he has a lot to say on the subject. John, you're very welcome to the program. Remind me, strokes is, it's when a blood vessel bursts or something gets stuck in the brain. What exactly is happening in a stroke?
Yeah, so strokes come in two flavors, just like you said. One is when a blood vessel gets blocked, so the tissue is deprived of blood and oxygen and dies. Another way to kill the tissue is the blood vessel can burst and the blood products exert so much pressure that they kill the tissue. But the consequence is similar, that you lose a piece of your brain.
Yeah.
And because strokes can happen almost anywhere, there's a very large diversity of deficits that you can have. The most common are loss of strength and coordination down one half of your body, and then also loss of language and speech. Those are the big ones.
Mm.
But there can be many, many other kinds of deficits.
So the symptoms of a stroke obviously are as diverse as the brain itself in a way.
In a way, that's exactly right. Mm. And, you know, there was one neurologist that said that you learn your neurology one stroke at a time.
Right.
Yeah.
All right. So let's talk a little bit about what happens after a stroke, because I thought it was really interesting. You were talking in a video I was watching about rats who had been given stroke and their ability to perform functions they'd been trained to do after they had the stroke. And what was really striking to me was how quickly we lose our ability to get back to where we were. That you know, the idea of let the person rest or let the mouse rest and get back to health and then we'll start the rehab. That is a terrible idea.
Yeah.
But we've been doing that for decades. It's starting to change now, right?
Yeah, great question. I mean, you know, in neurology in general, there in many areas, there were these ideas that, you know, when you have an aneurysm burst, you should let the patient cool down for a couple of weeks. We learned that was not a good thing to do. You want to fix the aneurysm as quickly as possible. Then there were blockages in your carotid arteries that caused strokes. And the idea was that you could clean out that artery, but you should wait. And then it turned out that was a bad idea. You should do the surgery as soon as possible. So there's almost like a trend when it comes to diseases of the nervous system, where in the past, there was a kind of relaxed view, you know, and then it's become increasingly obvious you shouldn't do that, right? And you know, recovering from stroke is no exception to that, is that there do seem to be conditions, we call them a critical period, a window of plasticity, where you just seem to be more responsive to training early versus late. Now, of course, that leads to the question of what is early versus late. There hasn't been anywhere near as much research proving that definitively in humans as you would think. In other words, it's been around for over a century now in monkeys and then in rodents. So it's bizarre. I mean, as I've said in a book that I wrote, if an alien came from outer space, they'd be bewildered by how this knowledge had not translated.
Mm.
But you're right, though, that it is changing. I mean, guidelines are beginning to realize that you need to give higher intensity, higher dose behavioral training at any point, actually, but it seems to be more effective if you do it early.
So say, for example, use of my arm, for example. I get a stroke, I lose the use of my arm. Mm-hmm. In a way, I sort of feel like it's like the instructions of how to use that arm were on a whiteboard, and that whiteboard has gotten wiped clean. But we can rewrite those instructions on the arm. It is possible to train our arm to do that again. Why does the whiteboard get wiped clean in the first place?
Well, I think I'm just going to correct that a little bit. There are deficits that seem to be higher order like that. It's not that your arm can't execute, you just don't know the right instructions to send to it.
Right.
But actually, garden variety stroke hits the descending pathway from your brain to your spinal cord to control muscles. So it's really almost more like a cable has been cut.
Okay.
So it's more basic than that. Where you're correct is that you can't repair that broken cable, but there's usually residual descending pathways that you need to kind of bring online.
Right.
So in a way, you're right, which is what's the best way to make use of the nervous tissue you have left that has the latent capacity to do the job, but needs to be cajoled into doing it? In other words, that's the way to think about it, is you've got this residual architecture, and in a way, there's a kind of use it or lose it kind of situation.
So the pathway to your traditional way of using that arm, that's gone. That will never come back
not entirely.
Right.
In other words, it you often, like in spinal cord injury is rarely total.
Right.
Very rarely total. Right. So in other words, the challenge in stroke and spinal cord injury is how do you amplify, bring online the residual pathways that have the capacity but just aren't doing it.
Right.
I mean, an example I can give you is, you know, are you right or left-handed?
I'm right-handed.
Yeah. So your left hand writing would be awful.
Yeah.
Right? It probably is, right?
But, so is my right hand, but I know what you mean.
But you could, over time, do better.
Yeah.
With your left hand, right? So there's a mixture of capacity to learn to use the residual, you know, descending pathways and train them once you bring them online. So yeah. What we're beginning to think is you need to bring them online somehow, and the probability of them being brought online is greater early than later.
Right.
And then when you bring them online, you have to consolidate that by training the hell out of them.
Okay, so typically what we used to do then was we'd get people to perform, if it was my arm, for example, perform either weightlifting or grabbing things and just repetitive sort of motion in a gym or a physio or in the hospital and doing some sort of rehab. Is that the idea, that we would sort of force our brain to try and do that movement, and that would generally yield some results?
You're articulating it and questioning in a way, I think, more than the profession did traditionally. In other words, physical and occupational therapy, physiotherapy, were not born out of a focus on nervous system disease. They came from orthopedics, and occupational therapy came from psychiatry, from Johns Hopkins, believe it or not. Right? It was for patients with mental illness to sort of get themselves back into everyday activities.
Right.
So in other words, the origin story is not to fix the nervous system. So fixing was never the job of rehabilitation. It was to train you to cope with what you have left in 101 ingenious ways. I'm in no way trying to diss the profession. It's just it wasn't thinking about the nervous system in that way. Most physical and occupational therapists do not look at brain scans. Mm. You know, they don't do physiological measurement.
Yeah.
Do you see? It was more like social work for the body. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah, and this idea that it was fully mechanical as opposed to movement being a cognitive thing. That's something that happens in the brain.
That is absolutely right. I think it was seen much more peripheral, biomechanical, musculoskeletal than it was... Yes, exactly. I mean, you put it exactly right. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I want to get on to your work because I find it really, really interesting, because you wanted to try and change the landscape a little bit in terms of how we treat stroke patients. And you did this in a number of unusual ways. And the first was hiring an animator. And I've heard you talk about it, but I haven't understood why you chose animation as opposed to a sculptor or a poet. Or why did you hire an animator into a scientific lab?
Well, it wasn't just animators. It was a group of, you know, software engineers, you know, hardware engineers, animators. It was really to try and create the human equivalent of what in the animal literature is called enriched environments. In other words, for 75 years or so, it's been known that if you take rodents with any disease and you put them in a cage with friends, with ramps, with balls, with spaces to explore, with bright colors, they do much better at the level of the nervous system tissue. You can actually see things like dendritic arborization, axonal sprouting, all sorts of things just from exercise, socialization, and fun.
Yeah.
Right? And of course, that was never the model taken. I mean, there were hints of that in psychiatric disease, right? You used to have sanitariums, used to have orchards and art classes and walks in the park and, you know, that sort of multidisciplinary approach. But then, no. We don't want that. Those shut down. The homeless problem in the United States is, you know, a large percentage of the people are psychiatric patients with nowhere to go. We had lobotomies and drugs. You know, we wanted magic bullet approaches, right? And so that's what happened. In other words, even though, there are enriched environments that are working on rodents, but how are we going to identify the active ingredient? Let's just short-circuit all that complexity and just go for the drug that will do it or the surgery that will do it.
Right.
So it was the road not taken in a way. And then the only place where you could see a little attempt of that were in pediatric hospitals, where they tried to paint the walls a nice color and put a few Disney characters on the walls. And
but I mean, that wasn't a therapeutic decision. That was a decision because children like playful things, right? And what's
that's
really
right? Yeah, exactly right. It was not direct. Whereas what the enriched environment was suggesting is that it's directly therapeutic.
Yeah, because right? I mean, you think about it. Actually, when you think about where rehab takes place, it's in these awful. Yeah, they're like white and green, horrible places. Somewhere you just initially don't want to be or interact.
Absolutely right.
So I mean, talk to me about the your animator and this the this unusual environment you're creating for the brain to allow it to rehab quicker and better.
Right. I mean, I think it was very much this idea. First of all, you want people to think that they're going somewhere where instead of exactly like you said, feeling a little down and depressed and sick, you make it an event, a happening, an experience. You know, you go with your family, right? And then what you want to do is you want this space to feel exactly the opposite of what you said. You know, it's beautiful. You know, it's like going to a neuro spa. You know, the lights go down, the music comes on, it's gorgeous. Your deficit isn't being accentuated. It's the quality of your movements immediately in this animated space. So you want to create sort of a character that you control in the foreground against a beautiful background. It's almost like you are one of the animals in a David Attenborough documentary. Mm. I mean, people love, you know, patients love David Attenborough documentaries, right? And so we wanted to go, you know, a mixture of a David Attenborough documentary and a Pixar movie where you star in it, but you're forced to be skillful in it. It's not like video games where you can get away, like in FIFA, looking fantastic, and all you're doing is button pressing. So you see, all these factors had to come together, right, to sort of trick somebody into enjoying themselves while sick.
So you developed this sort of a game to rehabilitate patients where you play a dolphin. Is that right?
Yes. Well, there are other cetaceans as well, but the basic idea was this, that we wanted you to be in an immersive environment. So you're in a room, there's a projection of the ocean in front of you, and in that ocean, with large amplitude movements of your arm, you control the intention of the dolphin, which has to eat fish and avoid sharks, and then go into battle at the harder levels with the sharks. But the point here is that the animals have responsive dynamics. In other words, it's not like all pre-drawn and you just play it out. In other words, this animal responds to your movements and has physics of its own. And the idea is that by getting more adept at steering the dolphin's body and interacting, you develop a skill. And the only way to develop that skill is to make art movements that are closer to normal. And so that's the idea, is that while you're doing this, your movements are getting better and better as you get more skilled as a cetacean in the ocean.
And you know what's different about the game that you designed? One of the first ones that I saw was this dolphin game, where you sort of get to flip around in the water and do it. Is that it is really well designed? And a lot of the times when I see people using video games for medical reasons, they've thought about just the result they're looking for and not the experience of playing that game, which means essentially you're going through the inverted commas game. But this looked like a fun thing that people wanted to do, which presumably means that those patients are looking forward to their rehab session. How do you connect a video game in which you play a dolphin? How do you connect that to the sort of movement that you want a stroke patient to do so that they get the exact right rehab? Because I mean, as you say, you don't want someone button mashing. You want you want the correct move, because there are obviously physiological movements you need them to do to train their brain to move again, right?
Yeah, you know, I'm remembering the last time you and I spoke how good your questions are. You really do ask the perfect questions. That's right. So in other words, the whole point is that you want them to play and only do well at the game if they make high quality movements that begin to converge back onto the way they were before, rather than what we call in the field compensatory movements, where you just come up with another way of doing it. What you want is for their nervous system to find another way of doing a movement that looks normal, rather than finding another way of doing the movement itself, which is what rehab was about.
Which are two very distinct things.
That's right.
You want the correct movement rather than coping with the deficit. You want actually to train it to do the original movement so that you get full rehab.
And that's exactly right. In other words, there are behavioral interventions which are about having the nervous system find another way to make movements that can get closer to normal, rather than using the brain's learning capacity to make you make new compensatory coping movements. And even though the brain ultimately is responsible for learning the compensatory movements and for generating the near-normal movements, the mechanisms are not the same, and the training approaches for those two ways of affecting the brain are also not the same. It's quite subtle, actually. And so you have to create a game that doesn't really care if you're accomplishing a pragmatic task in the world. It's just having you do the movements that get you towards normality. And of course, I always say it's a non-task-based task. You know, being a dolphin in the ocean is not something you're going to be doing at home on everyday life, right? So in other words, it's entirely focused on the movement quality, the cognitive challenge of generating those movements, and then you hope that because you've had an effect on the nervous system itself, it will generalize to more boring movements once you get back to everyday life.
Right. So last time we spoke, I was easy on you because these were great ideas, but we didn't have an enormous amount of scientific evidence. Mm-hmm. Right. So this is what you were proposing, that actually if we make video games really immersive, fun to play, and then we force rehab patients to make the movements we want them to move, we will get better results than we see in traditional rehab, even at an early stage. What has been the results of your work since we met?
So, great question again. So, there are two things that have to be separated a little bit. One is that we know now that high-intensity, high-dose rehabilitation, even of the traditional kind, given at higher dose, is better. So, in other words, more is better.
Yeah.
Okay. So, there are sort of two parallel developments in this field. Some people, and I'm friends and admire them, like most prominently Nick Ward, a professor of neurology at Queen's Square in London, who's developed this upper limb program where the patients come in for 3 weeks, chronic, they're not in the acute stage, and they do 5 to 6 hours a day for 3 weeks. I mean, this unprecedented amount of upper limb treatment. Now, when you compare just turning up to 11 all the regular rehab you get compared to regular, you get a jump. Now, it's interesting that in a paper that we have under review now, because I'm helping them, you know, we've all been involved in the scientific publication, what you notice is that there are many components to the motor deficit, and they don't all get better at the same rate and by the same amount.
Right.
Right. And what this increased dose of regular therapy has done is it has increased your strength, and it's increased your range of motion. And it's improved the quality of your movements as well, but not as much as those other two bits.
Right. Right?
But all of those together have good functional consequences.
Mm.
Right. Now, we, using technology in the subacute period, in the window, did twice as well as regular therapy with the dolphin.
Mm.
Okay. Now, if you do what Nick has done and go, okay, but don't compare the dolphin to regular therapy, up the number of hours of regular therapy, and then compare it to the dolphin. And in the first trial, they were equal.
Right.
Okay.
I think so, I know which one I'd prefer to do, but go on.
Yes. Now, what's interesting is that in those pilot data, even though it was underpowered, there was a suggestion that your quality of motor control was better in the dolphin group, and it had a delayed effect. In other words, you continue to improve after the training was over.
Right.
And we've just finished a trial with the dolphin in Parkinson's disease.
Wow.
Also seeing that effect, which is it's beneficial. You can see almost equal benefit if you do a lot of extra therapy in these patients. But there are components that are better if you do the dolphin. The cognitive bits, more delayed effects. So it's beginning to seem as though immersive gaming that focuses on cognition and high-quality movements, is the next phase after you do the basics with regular rehabilitation, like get your balance right, make sure you're not a danger to yourself. Mm. And so those trials are all positive. There's a trial finishing in New Zealand, which is going to really look to see whether, even when you match to more regular rehab, immersion's better. So we're waiting for those results. We also have a trial ongoing supported by the American Department of Defense in war veterans with traumatic brain injury to see if their cognition improves.
Mm.
And the data there are looking very promising. So what's beginning to unfold is it's at least as good and more fun. I mean, the patients, for example, in the Parkinson's study, more patients finished their therapy when it was dolphin than when they were doing the regular therapy.
Yeah.
And many patients, we've had a number of publications showing how much they enjoy it rather than being bored. So it's all accumulating, do you see? And I think it's going to be, I don't think it's going to substitute out regular rehab, because learning to cope is important. But if you want to rewire and fix, you'll do immersion. And if you want to then turn that into function, you'll translate over to incorporating into real life. So I'm beginning to see it's going to sort of be a binary star between plasticity, dependent retraining of the nervous system with high intensity, high dose, regular treatment, and they complement each other perfectly.
So let's talk a little bit about AI, because it seems to me, that we are starting to get to a place where therapeutically AI can be of real benefit. We're starting to see how it can, look at scans of eyes and pick up things that doctors can't and so on.
Right.
When it comes to reading all the data off these machines that you're attaching to people to give them better rehab movement, how are you incorporating AI into the use of rehab? And does it have the power to do something quite dramatic, do you think?
Yeah, I think there are two ways to think about AI, right? One is the way you've just asked, which is a really great tool to do better therapeutically, versus believing that it's a model for intelligence and that maybe it's the way to understand and mimic what they call AGI, artificial general intelligence. Now, I am very critical of the latter and very pro the former. We ourselves are using AI in a number of ways. I mean, one way obviously is what you said, that if you collect a lot of data, you can begin to see structure that may not have been obvious. You may be able to stratify patients in different groups. You can find responders and non-responders. Mm. You can go, oh, that was the critical ingredient in all that stuff. We would never have seen it.
Well, we saw a study last week in Japan, I think it was, reduced mortality from cardiac events by 33%, like an extraordinary, just by monitoring in hospital, looking at the scans and going, keep an eye on this one looks okay. I think it's one of the most significant we've ever heard on this program. So there is that ability to look at movement and so on. How would that inform something like rehab, for example?
In rehabilitation, non-neurological, people have used sort of apps and stratification to decide whether you're at risk low back pain patient versus a not at risk. I mean, there are many ways now to use it to triage, stratify, identify risk factors, predict, in other words, fall prediction, for example, all sorts of things, right? So that's sort of data in service to stratification, triaging, and prediction.
Yeah.
Right? We're using it more as a therapeutic directly.
So okay.
In other words, one is motion capture. In other words, you can begin to actually see the kinematics, the quality of the movements with, cameras that can detect 3D movements. So in other words, you can, and then the machine learning algorithm can sort of classify and, track how much better you're getting. So there's that.
Yeah.
You can also now use all these fantastic foundation models, the large language models. You've seen them all. They can generate pictures and backgrounds.
Mm.
So you could imagine that you could have a movement quality linked background. So the better your movements get, the more beautiful the room you're in becomes.
Yeah.
Right? So that's really promising to have these closed loop aesthetic improvements.
Wow.
Right? So I'm having a 3-day event in Portugal this week called Metamersion, where, I'm trying to set up a center for digital therapeutics there. And we're bringing together all these technologies: gaming animation, motion capture, generative AI,
wow,
all of it, VR, AR, mixed reality, to sort of create these experiences. So motion capture, creating, beautiful foregrounds and backgrounds, that's all fantastic. But that's more trying to create these enriched environments with this next-gen tech.
Yeah.
In addition to data and the way that I suggested. And then motion capture somewhere in between, right? In other words, if you do what we've been discussing to a patient in a clinic or in a hospital, it would be great to see what that does when they get home. Does it generalize to their everyday activity? So now we're getting better with wearables, with cameras, to go, look how well they chopped those onions in the kitchen now. You can actually capture it.
Mm.
So, and then you go, ah, they're deteriorating. They're losing what they gained in our immersive environment. They need to come back to the NeuroStar.
Right, right,
or you give them tele-rehab homework. You can actually have a game at home. So there are all these ways that sort of AI, both from the data tracking point of view and AI from the therapeutic generation point of view, are coming together. I'm very excited about that.
It sounds very expensive, John. And how do you, you know, how do you make this accessible for every patient? Because, you know, one of the things about those major players like Meta and Microsoft and Sony, they, you know, they make these devices that are very powerful that could be so beneficial, but often aren't because they're not designed to be that way. How do you get this sort of technology available so that a hospital can afford something, you know, state-of-the-art treatment?
Yeah, I mean, this is a very broad question. Mm. In other words, again, hospitals spend a lot of money on MRI scanners and CAT scanners, and, you know, surgeries cost an enormous amount. The hospitals like to charge huge amounts of money for procedures, mainly elective procedures, right? And, you know, in the United States, drugs cost an enormous amount of money, right? The reason why it all we get away with it is because the insurers, the payers, pay for it.
Yeah.
Right. At the moment, the things we're discussing are not, for the most part, being paid for.
Mm.
So then there's the, so in other words, until it gets paid for, you're in this self-pay model. You're absolutely right. And then there's also what's called value-based care, where you begin to convince large chains of hospitals that this is going to reduce costs for them. How the patients don't get rehospitalized, they don't depend on home health as much. The length of stay in the hospital is shorter.
Mm.
In other words, there are many ways that this would actually be great for the economy and reduce costs, right? So we're not looking for something that's just going to be a luxury.
Yeah.
But, you know, as you said, I mean, the Apple goggles cost an enormous amount of money. And I don't know what the uptake is, but I think they're being challenged by the price. So, yes, I think what we have to do is show large effect size, the kind that you mentioned for that other study out of Japan.
Yeah.
And then begin to, people will vote with their feet and go, actually, I'd rather have this than pay vast amounts of money for that drug.
Yeah.
So, yes, but I'm not, it's not as true as you think because people already spend inordinate amounts of money on medicine.
Hmm.
Right.
How far away are you finally from using something like AI to predict a training plan based on performance?
Yeah, that's to close that loop entirely is difficult. We're not, but we are going to get there. We're going to see the machine learning may actually find the right way that you progress through the levels of the game based on how you're performing and do a better job than us saying, okay, move to the next level of the game, make it this difficult because you're doing better. There's no question that that loop will be closed. Mm. It's just we're not there yet.
Well, John, fascinating work. It's great to have you in studio. I hope you enjoy your trip to Dublin. And John is giving a talk at Trinity College Dublin about this and about AI. And that's why he's here this week. Very charismatic guy in person, John. Really enjoyed that interview. And that's an extended version from what you would have heard on the radio show. Now to some of your comments from last week. We were talking about soundproof silk. Researchers had found a way of making really thin silk that deadened sound by 30 decibels. Incredible. Someone says, my wife just turned to me and says, can you have one made into a face mask? Chris. Thanks, Chris. And Fabian Klenner, who was talking about the Europa Clipper last week, mission to Jupiter's moon, and basically trying to find a way to see if we could perhaps find life there by sampling some of the material jettisoned from eruptions that happen on the surface of Europa. Austin Infomoy has a good question. He says, hi lads, how long does the moon spend in Jupiter's shadow and will living there be feasible if those time periods are too long? I looked this up, Austin. It's about two and a half hours is all it's in Jupiter's shadow. But those eclipses where the moon is hidden from the sun have a remarkable effect on the surface temperature. You're quite right. And it drops by 50 degrees. The problem is that the hottest it gets on the surface of Europa is only 100 Kelvin, which is around minus 171 degrees centigrade. Not super conducive to any sort of exciting life that we have here on Earth. And then that drops in shadow to around 50, which is minus 220 degrees centigrade. So any chances of finding anything interesting on that planet, I think, are slim enough. And it's a question I should have asked. So, Austin, thank you for that. That's it from us on this week's Future Proof. Thanks to Aidan McKelvey and you for listening. We'll be back with more on Tuesday in your podcast feed. In the meantime, stay curious.
Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland.
Sunday morning at 10 on News Talk.